Welcome, dumbheads, to this week's megasode of MDC, the Mega Dumbcast. Monday through Saturday, I drop one micro-podcast per day identifying the dumbest thing on every single goddamn page of Ninjas and Super Spies, the ridiculous RPG from Palladium Books. On Sundays, I combine all the previous week's episodes in one megasode, like this one. If you want to follow along at home, we are reading Revised Ninjas and Super Spies, 7th printing, from the year 2000. Today we're discussing page 121 of Ninjas and Super Spies. I am back from England. It was a great trip that I won't talk about here because I only go on for about 5 minutes a day. If you want to hear me ramble about England, you can check out Gameable, the very long podcast counterpart to this very short one. One thing I will mention, though, here at the top of the episode, not directly related to page 121, is that Mega Dumbcast, Mega Fan, Mega Dumbhead, Dr. G has a podcast called Dial G for Gamer. I was on it. We talked about Heroes Unlimited, so listeners to this podcast will definitely want to go hear me talk about Heroes Unlimited in a long-form way with Dr. G on episode 4 of Dial G for Gamer. That's at pulptopixel.blogspot.com. Okay, so that's enough preliminaries. Let's talk about page 121. The first thing you can't help but notice is a big old half-page illustration of some poor schmuck with a sword getting his ears blown out by a shouting middle-aged man sitting cross-legged on the ground with his shirt open, his unimpressive physique bared to the world. He has a bit of a David Carradine look about him, and the expression on his face is not one that I at least would associate with superhuman shouting. He looks very matter-of-fact. He looks like this shit happens to him all day, every day. Somebody runs at him with a sword and he's got to sit down cross-legged and just yell to put them in their place. They look pretty well shocked. He looks like he wishes just once someone would believe him that he has super yelling powers and he didn't have to prove it every time. But we already talked about kaijutsu, the art of dangerous yelling, back when we talked about Lee Kuan Chu. So today we're going to talk about something a little different. We're going to wrap up our discussion of chi mastery with a dark chi power. This is dark chi or chakuri chi. This is a chi power that allows you to tap the dark chi of the dark parts of the world. So what's interesting here is that while we've discussed that waterfalls are great places to kill people if you are pure of heart, because there's a lot of positive chi there for you to tap and use to make yourself super strong or run super fast or whatever, if you are a bad person, you don't want to go fight at waterfalls. There's no negative chi there for you to tap. Even places like volcanoes, which you would think maybe would benefit, like that's a violent place. There's explosions. You would think there's got to be a lot of dark chi here for me to use. Heed the example of Scar and of Anakin Skywalker. Volcanoes are no place for you. That is natural beauty, albeit of a hard-edged variety, and it will ultimately benefit the good guy. Fortunately, Ninjas and Super Spies has your back. It tells you exactly where you need to go to pick up some sweet, sweet dark chi from your surroundings. What you're looking for are caves, tombs, basements, and tunnels. Now, in that list, caves are the only things that are really naturally occurring. So I'm willing to accept that if you go into a cave, if you go underground in a natural environment, then the chi under there is dark chi. There is a balance to the world, yada, yada, yada. So if you're a bad guy, then you got to go underground to do your kung fu. What I would not have anticipated is that this balance of dark and light in the cosmos is quite so easy to game as to be able to dig a hole underground, essentially a tunnel, or a basement, and be able to access these realms of dark power because you are down in your finished basement. You can, I guess, probably it's even stronger dark chi if you get down on all fours and crawl under the pool table down there. That's even closer to the ground, even further toward the center of the planet. There's even more dark chi down there. Yes, this does mean that if you go on the submarine ride at Disneyland, there's probably plenty of dark chi down there. But what came to my mind when I read this, because it's amazing to me how easy it is to find dark chi. All you've got to do is get in a basement. These are the dark studios we've heard so much about in relation to Snake Style. You may recall that when you join Snake Style, then you have to swear a blood oath and you have to be personally selected by other evil people for your evil potential, and they take you to their dark studios to train. this is what that means. It's basements. If you're into a keto, then you got to go, you got to do that shit in the quad. That's why you always see people doing Tai Chi and stuff out in slow motion, out in the open, in the sunshine at your university or in the park or whatever, because that's where the positive chi is. But if you want to learn snake style, you got to go to some creepy old goateed man. And he's like, yes, your goatee is just beginning, but I see that it has great potential. Please join me in this basement where our power is strongest. It's very much like, I think Anton LaVey was probably a master of snake style. He seems like the kind of dude who has that like affected darkness and will definitely invite you into a basement to do something that he promises will charge you with dark power. Anyway, the fact that scary, scary bad guys have to practice their kung fu in basements because that's where the powers of darkness are strongest, that's the dumbest thing on this page. Today we're discussing page 122 of Ninjas and Super Spies, and this is going to be the story of one martial arts trope. One special thing that a kung fu master can do, one trick you can try to pull off at your table in various ways. Today we're discussing the martial arts technique with the long, annoying to say name, one life, one shot, one hit, one kill. Obviously, we can't discuss this too much because I will quickly blow through the 5-minute time limit, roughly, that I put on these episodes. However, we are going to spend the entire episode discussing the possibilities of this one power, one life, one shot, one hit, one kill. It's very simple in its basic application. You stare at somebody. You squint at them, you size them up, you do like a samurai in a samurai movie and see what you think about their abilities, and you aim your shot, you imagine it in your mind. This takes 15 seconds, a full melee. You give up all your attacks and defenses or whatever. You do nothing but the steely Kurosawa style gaze at your foe. Then, using one weapon, you make one attack and you use one life, one shot, one hit, one kill to possibly inflict a critical hit. You get a +1 bonus for every full 15 seconds you spent doing a samurai stare at your foe. And if your strike bonus is 20 or better, then it's a crit, which does double damage. Now, you may ask yourself, why would I sacrifice 3 attacks, which is probably about what I get in a melee round, in order for not the guarantee, but the possibility of an attack that does double damage? Well, you might do it if your foe is particularly hard to hit, but because this bonus to hit only accrues at +1 per melee, you know, if you're pretty far away from hitting your foe in an average roll, like, you know, maybe 4 away on a d20, you're talking about staring at this person for a full minute while they're having a kung fu fight with you before you make your move. So it's useful in a very narrow situation. Trying to wring damage out of this, like trying to make critting on somebody better than just trying again and again to hit them, it's pretty weak. However, the thing I really want to discuss about one life, one shot, one hit, one kill, the whole thing every time, is that you can use this with any weapon. Unlike other martial arts techniques, it is not limited to traditional ninja shit. You can use any weapon you can find and get a special weapon kata for and take destined martial arts fueled shots at your foes. This is where you may be able to get some utility out of this power if your GM is willing to let you do very dumb things, which, let's be honest, he's running Ninjas and Super Spies. He's willing to do dumb things. So you could press your advantage here. There's no point in doing this with a katana, right? A katana does like 3d6 damage if it's a good katana. Why would you waste 15, 30 seconds, a minute trying to get 6d6 out of a 3d6 weapon when you could hit somebody like 6, 9, 12 times with that same weapon? It's stupid. There's no reason to do it. Because you can, if you've got a katana, there's no reason you have to wield it like a wily samurai in a samurai movie. You can just slash away at it. You can just go full Baraka on somebody and just slash them, and get 3d6 out of every attack, right? You're going to miss some, but you're also going to hit some. And every time you roll, it's a chance to roll a crit. However, not every weapon can be fired every round. Not every weapon hits only one target. Not every weapon does a mere 3d6 damage. And not every weapon has inexhaustible ammo. For example, consider the grenade. Now, we don't often see in cinema samurai having grenade fights, more's the pity. But if you were to grab a grenade and give somebody the samurai eyes and then attack them using one life, one shot, one hit, one kill, you would find that the damage, if you get your crit, is going to be tremendous. And depending on your GM, it may be applied to everyone in the blast radius if it is possible to crit an area effect attack. Grenades are expensive single-use weapons, so it might be worth it both in terms of ammo and in terms of damage to use a grenade with one life, one shot, one hit, one kill. But there are other options as well. Consider the 90mm recoilless rifle if you're into heavy artillery. This thing can do relatively rapid fire of anti-tank rounds one at a time. You can get out up to 5 rounds in 30 seconds, but if you want to go for sustained fire, you can only fire once per minute. The damage on this, though, is 1d10 times 100, or 1d10 mega damage for the Rifts players in the audience. As long as you're using anti-tank rounds against personnel, why not amp up the overkill by enhancing each one with one life, one shot, one hit, one kill? Even if that's only getting your bonus high enough to crit maybe every other anti-tank round, it's easily worth it for the extra 500 points of damage. But if you want maximum bang for your buck, you want to get yourself a vehicle stopper, a euphemistically titled wrist weapon for super spies, which can stop a vehicle in much the same way that a landmine can stop a squirrel. The vehicle stopper is designed to do massive damage with a single shot. It can do 2d6 mega damage, and this time that mega damage rating is right in the book. This is, as far as I can recall off the top of my head, the only weapon that explicitly does mega damage in Ninjas and Super Spies. If you're a spy and you find yourself in a situation where you may need to unexpectedly blow up a semi with a weapon you can carry in a concealable unit on your wrist, but only one semi, it's a single shot weapon, then you want a vehicle stopper. So the vehicle stopper, 2d6 mega damage, converts to an average of 700 damage in a single shot, and it takes a while to reload. So you got to make that shot count. So what you want to do is muster all your kung fu power and invoke one life, one shot, one hit, one kill. You extend your wrist. You focus all your wisdom on a single attack. And then you fire a massive cannonball-like explosive charge at precisely the right spot in your opponent so that you inflict not a mere 700 damage, but 1400 damage. With the mystical power of one life, one shot, one hit, one kill, you can kill motherfuckers with the power of anti-vehicle rounds and with the finesse of a true samurai. And that's the dumbest thing on this page. I do want to note before we go that depending on your reading of the rules, you may or may not need a special weapon kata in order to use a weapon with a martial art in this fashion, meaning you need a martial arts style that offers special katas and martial arts techniques, such as jiu-jitsu, which seems just about right for that style. There's a big difference between hitting your foe with a ring of keys and an anti-tank weapon, but I feel it's in the same spirit. Today we're discussing page 123 of Ninjas and Super Spies. We are on to special katas. These are highly specialized, prescribed forms of combat that martial artists learn and then regret. Because, as we will discover, special katas are a little bit overly specialized. Despite most of them not actually offering specific moves for you to do the way the real kata would, instead, what these katas do is lock you into one approach to combat. Of the ones on page 123, there's one that isn't really a kata at all, the weapon kata we've discussed before that just allows you to add a weapon to a martial art form. All the actual katas on this page are ineffective against one guy hitting you as hard and as often as he can. Just something as simple as that. That is the key to cut the Gordian knot of the many centuries of specialized martial arts techniques and katas. One guy punching you in the face as often as he can is just no can defense. There is no way to deal with this innovative offense. But over the years, many have tried. So here are some examples of that. First of all, there is the one mind kata or kime kata. This is flexible. It's attack or defense. what it amounts to is one of your attacks or defenses in the round, you double your roll. Either you double a hit roll, or you double a damage roll, or you double a parry roll, or you double a dodge roll. Then you get no bonuses at all to the rest of your actions during the round, and they either all have to be attacks or all have to be defenses. So you do one really awesome parry and then a bunch of shitty parries with no bonus, or you do one really great punch and then a bunch of punches with no bonus, whatever. This is effective only against other martial artists who are being overly clever with their offense. You would only ever use this if you've got somebody who's got one really good big attack to drop on you, and nothing else. Because if they do have anything else coming at you, you know, if you're up against somebody who can throw multiple effective attacks per round, you'd much rather have a good chance of defending against all of them rather than definitely defending against one and having the rest pretty much always hit you. Let's say you're up against a group of unskilled combatants in a bar who think Kung Fu is stupid, and they decide to jump you. And you think, well, okay, fortunately, I have my one mind Kime Kata. So when the first one runs up to you and tries to smack you, you roll a super parry and you get, you know, a 40 to parry or whatever and knock his hand out of the way. And then he and the rest of his friends pummel you for the rest of the round since you have no more bonus to parry. But maybe you would fare better if you had the Warrior Spirit Kata or Debana o Kujiki Kata. This is a special kata that entails not just no specific moves, but in fact, no moves at all. In Warrior Spirit Kata, the idea is that you just look like such a badass that people don't want to fight you. You either stand still with your hands on your hips like Superman, or you walk forward resolutely, making no attacks, but just, you know, walking like nobody should get in your way. And this increases your effective mental affinity to 20, or by 6 if you already have an MA of 20 or better, giving you a chance to intimidate your foes, who, if they are intimidated, there's about a 65% chance that never goes up for most characters, then they will either back down or run away, or simply fight you with a penalty of -4 to hit. So suppose you're in a aforementioned bar, and you're surrounded by a group of assailants who think Kung Fu is stupid. You heard about that asshole who knows Kime who got beat up the other night. These guys are looking for a fight, so you think, okay, I'm not sure I can actually take them, but fortunately, I know Warrior Spirit Kata. So you point yourself toward the door, you turn on your Warrior Spirit Kata, you start walking toward that door. You've got a 65% chance to intimidate whoever you're up against, which means 65% of the people in this crowd either back down or run away, or can still try to hit you, but just not as effectively. 35% of them are unaffected. So one of the third of the people in the crowd, but let's say it works on more than 65% of them by dumb luck. Let's say that it works on all but one of them who walks up to you and smacks you in the face as hard and as often as he can. You can roll defenses normally, but you can't fight back. He wins the round. Once again, unskilled combat is the champion, my friends. It turns out that standing there doing nothing is not, in fact, the ultimate fighting technique. But maybe if we had a special kata that was designed for multiple combatants. So let us turn to next Friday at the bar, where a master of Taido goes in and runs afoul of the same group of rowdy goons. But he thinks, I've got this on lock. I know the kata of five principles. This is designed specifically for multiple combatants. Unlike most katas, it actually gives me specific moves to use. Everything anyone tries to do to me, I get a circular parry and a multiple dodge. So they try to pick a fight with you because they think Kung Fu is stupid. You activate your Kata of Five Principles. Unfortunately for you, Kata of Five Principles can only be used against multiple attackers. Now, last week, there was a guy here who, let's be fair, scared a lot of these folks. They were affected by his warrior spirit and did not attack him. So while they still think Kung Fu is stupid, they're not really eager to get into a fight. They just want to watch that one guy from last week beat your ass. So he walks up to you, and since he's not a multiple attacker, I'm sorry, there's nothing the Kata of Five Principles can do. When this unskilled combatant walks up to punch you in the face as hard and as often as he can, you are defenseless. Strike three for Kung Fu. The boys down at the We Hate Kung Fu bar are emboldened. They're just waiting for another Kung Fu hotshot to come down to the bar. And indeed one does, because on the final Friday of the month, in comes a true Kung Fu master who has learned Yodome Jutsu, or Windmill Kata. This is a badass samurai skill. In real life, it's the ability to use a sword to take out arrows coming at you. it's kind of debatable whether this is a thing people can really do or just kind of a kung fu parlor trick that certain people have arranged to pull. But in Ninjas and Super Spies, you don't even need a sword. All you do is make a kind of windmill motion with your arms, like Andy Kaufman fighting Jerry Lawler, and you can deflect and or grab any hand-propelled object thrown at you, including arrows, thrown spears, darts, and rocks, we are assured. So if you're up against a group of people throwing rocks at you, I'm sure this will cool their jets, make them reconsider their beef with you when they try to stone you and you use your fancy pants kung fu to catch their rocks out of the air. And you better hope it cools all of these tempers, because windmill kata is ineffective against other kinds of attacks. So when the boys down at the We Hate Kung Fu bar and grill decide to attack the final kung fu master and he starts spinning his arms like a windmill, some of them may decide to throw darts from the dartboard. Some of them may throw bottles, and he is going to catch them out of the air, but that's only going to result in his hands being full when one brave member of the group walks forward to punch him in the face as hard and as often as he can, and windmill kata is ineffective. Unskilled combat prevails. Kung fu is stupid. QED. The fact that the entire selection of special katas, many of which are defense-focused, contains none that are effective against just being hit, that's the dumbest thing in this page. A real missed opportunity. With the close runner-up being the fact that special katas are described as a series of prescribed movements that, by and large, do not actually prescribe any movements, and one of which is just literally not doing anything and looking scary. Today we're discussing page 124 of Ninjas and Super Spies. We're just wrapping up the martial arts powers, which have not been all they were cracked up to be. They look really cool on the surface, but when you dig into them, you find the anti-fun police of Palladium kind of ruining your day a little bit when you want to play a ninja. And it's no exception here in the Zenjōriki section, the catch-all martial arts powers section for kind of spooky spiritual martial arts powers, Jedi stuff, basically. This page offers you the ability to send your spirit outside your body to wander the world like a force ghost, the ability to do a vibrating resonance technique that allows you to break shit with your vibrating hand, the ability to calm the minds of others, and Kurumi Jutsu, which is Palladium's opportunity to offer you the ability to do all kinds of cool wirefoo stuff and then shit all over it. Kurumi Jutsu allows you to reduce your weight by 85%, which gives you the ability to do all kinds of cool stuff. You can, for example, walk on teacups. It's a specific example given in the book. That's cool, right? Everybody wants to fight on teacups. You can jump a really long way. You can climb things you wouldn't normally be able to climb. So, you know, you could climb a sheer brick wall, or you could do a series of leaps up onto the thin branches of a tree, which will support you because you weigh only as much as a tiny bird. You don't take any damage for falling up to 2,000 feet, so you're able to do that cool thing where you fall out of the air and land on the balls of your feet, and you're just fine. But here's the problem. When these things happen in a kung fu movie, they happen, unsurprisingly, in the context of kung fu. You know, you're flying through the air from treetop to treetop, wielding your sword, right? Because you are having a kung fu fight. You're not just having fun dicking around in the trees. Not that you wouldn't do that, but that's not the part of the kung fu life that is depicted in kung fu movies. It's usually the rough part where you're fighting with other people who can also stand on treetops. It's not presumably the other 90% of kung fu life where you just throw your hands out and up like Naruto and jump around in the trees like, wee! Kung fu is fun most of the time. No, that's not what we want. What we want is kung fu action. And the problem with Kurumi Jutsu is that, quote, it requires total concentration, and the character can perform no other attacks, defenses, or actions during the melee round when the character is using the power. It goes on to say, quote, duration is indefinite as long as the character continues to concentrate on being lightweight. Combat will break the concentration. So yes, Palladium tells you, you can leap high into the air, you can make a 50-foot jump, you can climb way up on a sheer wall using only your fingertips, but if at any point you attempt to do kung fu, or if you have kung fu done to you, if you are, through no fault of your own, kung fu'd in midair, your concentration is broken, and you crash to earth. Like Icarus, you tried to rise up on invisible wires too close to the sun, and it was up to Palladium to come in and slap you down and remind you that while kung fu is cool, it's not that cool. You're not so great. lest you think you're such a hotshot that you can do cool things and engage the Palladium combat system. No way, buddy. You can frolic in the treetops, or you can get down into the melee and grind out four actions per round just like everybody else. This is actually pretty dangerous because you can end up high up in the air. I mean, of all the kung fu powers to have cut out at a crucial moment, the ability to climb fragile things, to stand on surfaces that can't support you, to fall without taking damage, and to leap high into the air, those are all things that, like, if they go wrong in the middle, you're in real trouble. I'm particularly amused by the thought of this happening to a Tiger Style master, because Tiger Claw Style automatically gets Kurumi Jutsu because you're supposed to be graceful like a cat. But if you attempt to actually like climb up a tree and then jump from tree to tree with Tiger Claw Style, and then somebody punches you, or somebody tries to punch you and you forget what you're doing and like parry out of instinct, suddenly your full weight returns and you are going to, in a very uncat-like fashion, crash and burn. You're going to go from full-on tiger mode to suddenly seeming very much like a dude in a tiger outfit, landing on his very human back in the dirt. Poetic justice for someone who attempts to weaponize the furry lifestyle? Perhaps. But nonetheless, it is bad game design. It is unnecessarily punishing game design. And it's the dumbest thing on this page. To watch a bunch of wire foo movies and come away with the impression that it is impossible to do kung fu while flying through the air, I think that kind of genre blindness pretty much throws a lot of light on the rest of the design of this book that is allegedly about cinematic ninjas. Today we're discussing page 125 of Ninjas and Super Spies. And you know, it's been 125 pages of Ninjas and Super Spies. We've talked a lot about skills. We've talked a lot about different martial arts styles. We've talked a lot about optional cybernetic parts that almost none of the characters in this game can have. We've talked about rules for creating rocket ships, about the theoretical impossibility of a human being being morally neutral. We've talked about exactly how much time it takes in therapy to overcome your hatred of women. And we've talked exhaustively about the many random effects that hard street drugs can have on the human mind and body. Now, at last, on page 125, we turn the page to see, in a big heading right at the top of the page, hand-to-hand combat. Oh, what a surprise. We're going to get rules for fighting hand-to-hand in this game about ninjas and super spies. I had almost lost hope. Now, conventional game design would probably have put these rules for hand-to-hand combat nearer the beginning of the book, before little subsystems like, you know, how to construct a super vehicle, probably before the exhaustive and voluminous descriptions of martial arts styles that you can't understand without having read this section. But as we'll see, they're not really rules in the standard RPG sense. It's more like a rambling elevator pitch from a game designer about how it's supposed to work. It's a lot of little kind of bullet point lists that go off the rails. It's a lot of examples that don't seem to quite fit together. A lot of promises of things to be filled in later that then aren't. As something of a game designer myself, I have an awful lot of text documents on my computer right now that look a lot like this section, and I feel they were probably written in the same way. Which is to say, someone got really excited about ninjas, wrote down rules about doing ninja stuff off the top of their head until they got hungry for a burrito and quit, which is what I'm going to do after I'm finished recording podcasts for the day. The top half of this page is not rules at all, but an illustration of a gentleman with a gi and an afro doing some kind of jump kick toward an older man with a bow staff. The illustration is nice enough, except for the fact that based on the angle of this jump kick, it appears to be aimed about a car length to the right of the intended victim. Or maybe these two aren't fighting. Maybe they're both working together and about to lay the smackdown on somebody who is off panel to the right. Beneath the illustration, we get the beginning of this game's best effort at explicit rules for combat. It's a noble effort. They're organized step by step, and each step offers an example of combat between these two characters named Bruno and Keijo, who have an ongoing battle through the examples in this book. We may talk a little about Bruno and Keijo another time, but for now what I want to talk about is just the overview, because this page gives you the five basic steps to combat in this game. First, you roll 20-sided dice for initiative, for the round, mind you. Not for the entire combat, but just for the one melee round. Then a strike roll, then a parry or dodge roll to avoid the attack, then a damage roll if the attack hits, then a roll with punch roll to reduce the damage you've just rolled from the attack. That much information is in the introduction to this section, before the rules are even described in any sort of detail, before step one in the combat flowchart. And already, this is a borderline unplayable pain in the ass. Like, you wouldn't need to know anything more about the combat system if you actually do the math on it than what is presented in the chapter opening summary to know this bullshit's not going to work. Let me give you a concrete example. In the back of this book, no spoilers, but there is a mook type character for an organization described in this book. It's a first level martial artist, a first level practitioner of Taekwondo. Let's talk about the simplest case of combat you could basically have in this game, which is two first level practitioners of a straightforward art like Taekwondo in a fight. Well, the first thing to know is that, as I mentioned before, every melee round has a separate roll for initiative. So, okay, that's two die rolls to start the round, and then we have to roll again next round. Now, every attack is going to involve quite a few dice rolls, assuming that the defenses don't successfully defend. We're dealing with a strike roll, a defense roll, parry or dodge, a damage roll, and a roll to roll with punch. So that's four dice rolls involved in each action. Note that I didn't say turn or round, but each action. Now, these first level little baby Taekwondo masters have four actions per melee round. Each of those actions involves four die rolls, which is 16 die rolls per character. There are two characters, so we double that to 32 rolls. We add the two for initiative. That's 34 die rolls to simulate 15 seconds of in-game combat between two of the simplest possible characters. Now, if we dip into Taekwondo, one of the nice things we find about Taekwondo is that it actually has a pretty damaging move. Once per round, you can do a roundhouse kick that does 2d6 damage. In the other rounds, Taekwondo Master use something like a regular kick attack, do maybe a d8 of damage. So assuming all of their many, many kicks hit, their average damage output for the round is like 7 for the roundhouse kick, plus an average of 4.5 for each of the kicks. Anyway, when you compare that to the hit points in the SDC of these characters, what you'll find is, even if all their kicks hit, they can't take each other down in a single round. Even one more roundhouse kick can't do it. They're going to need another kick to get through all that SDC and those hit points. That means we're going to have to enter another melee round, which involves two more dice rolls. And then we're going to have like two more actions each. Well, two for one of them and one for the other, who gets knocked out before he can take his second action. We were already at 34. Initiative takes us to 36. Player 1's action takes us to 40. Player 2's action takes us to 44. Player 1's second action takes us to 48. At which point, assuming that every parry or dodge failed, that every attempt to roll with punch and reduce damage failed, in other words, that damage output has been optimal, then what we have is a combat that has lasted about 22 seconds of in-game time and has required 48 dice rolls. Now, obviously, this is an unrealistic situation. Role-playing games aren't really played with just two players each playing a character. There's typically a party. Now, Palladium games often have pretty big parties, but let's just assume the minimum, realistically, that you would have playing Ninjas and Super Spies. Two hapless players, each playing first-level characters, like these Taekwondo guys, and then they're in a fight against... Now, you would love to do the classic thing with, like, the hordes of ninjas that the player characters, you know, go back-to-back, double dragon style, and take them down, but that's not feasible. Let's have a two-person horde of mooks, one per player. Let's just try to get that, locked down first. So it's two first-level characters versus two first-level NPCs. Random thugs all practicing a simple art like Taekwondo. That's going to double our number of dice rolls to 96, and it's unrealistic to assume that every single defense and every single roll with punch over the course of 96 rolls is going to fail. Let's assume that one time someone manages to successfully roll with punch and half the damage. That's going to extend combat by one action, as there's going to need to be an additional kick in there somewhere. That extra four dice rolls for one action is going to put us over the top, and we're going to have a fight that takes 22 seconds of time in the game world, involves two player characters and the GM playing two thugs, and requires us to roll the dice literally 100 times. I was in a creative writing class once, and sort of this classroom tangent came up about, like, how fast can you type? You know, if you're in the business of, like, writing multiple novels per month, how fast can you accurately type to get all of that content on paper? And I volunteered to the conversation, like, if the limiting factor on how fast you can write a novel is how fast you can physically hit the buttons on your keyboard, there's a problem with your novel that goes beyond, you know, time management. The bloat of the Palladium combat system is approaching the point where the speed with which people can find and roll their dice physically is actually becoming an impediment to playing this game. I mean, we've already hit 100 dice rolls for a combat that lasts less than 2 rounds and a PC group that only has 2 players in it. If we're dealing with a large group, like 6-player characters, we're rapidly approaching 150 dice rolls per round in the optimal scenario where the damage is done, the mooks go down, everybody's happy, and you move on, assuming that there's time left in the day. The fact that a 2-on-2 fight between speckly-faced teenage white belts at a Taekwondo dojo would require 100 die rolls to resolve is not only the dumbest thing on this page, but probably the greatest practical obstacle to actually playing a Palladium game. This is the sort of thing that turns people off of role-playing when they have their first experience with it, and Palladium richly deserves the abuse that has been heaped upon it for this shitty system. Today we're discussing page 126 of Ninjas and Super Spies, and dear listener, I have a confession to make. I don't understand how the fuck the roll-with-punch mechanic works in Palladium games. I never have. You might not guess this because I've talked about it at length on this and other podcasts. It has been the dark horse winner of the contest for like my most griped about game mechanic. We discussed last time when we talked about page 125 how long it takes to run combat in a Palladium system, and roll with punch is one of the big culprits. It constitutes one of the 4 rolls you might have to make every action in combat. And it's an especially egregious offender because it allows you to reduce the damage of an attack that's already hit. So after you've already rolled to punch, and you've already rolled to try and fail to parry the punch, you still get one more roll to try to make the punch less effectual so that combat will go on even longer. So already it has earned my ire. But its subtler and greater offense is just how screwed up the rules are around rolling with punch. For something that you might have to do every turn in combat, it's weird that it's totally incomprehensible. But indeed, here in the combat example, which as it turns out is the main source of combat rules in this book, it's a total mess. We're informed that if an attack does blunt physical damage, like a fist, foot, club, staff, etc., then the defender can try to roll with the punch to reduce the damage. Quote, in order to roll with punch, the defender must roll a 20-sided die and equal or better the attacker's roll to strike. Successfully rolling with a punch means the character takes half damage. Now, roll with punch is presented here as just something that happens every turn. Like the rise and the set of the sun, every time we go through a Palladium round, 15 seconds of game time, it takes about an hour of real life with your bored-ass friends sitting around the kitchen table. At the end, like the return of summer, we roll with punch to see if we can halfway undo all the progress we've made toward this miserable evening being over. However, while this step-by-step instruction sequence is the primary source of organized combat rules in the game, the primary source for disorganized nitty-gritty combat rules is actually the glossary, which comes soon. Don't worry, we will get there. And having trained hard on vehicle speed tables, I will attempt to make the glossary interesting. The glossary tells us about roll with punch, very much the same thing that the step-by-step instructions do on page 125. Then, when it goes on to describe the automatic roll maneuver, it says, quote, normally, a character can only roll with one attack in each melee round action. With automatic roll, the character can roll away from an unlimited number of attacks. So, a couple of things. First of all, in other Palladium games, it takes an action to roll with punch. That doesn't seem to be the case in Ninjas and Super Spies. However, there is a limitation on how often you can roll. And that limitation, as described only under automatic roll, by the way, so that if you don't have automatic roll, you'd never know this is in the game, is you can only do it once per melee round action. Now, only one person takes an action at a time in this system, so I can't imagine a situation where you'd ever have to roll with multiple attacks in the same action, because it's always someone's one action, right? This is a problem that comes up again and again in Ninjas and Super Spies. For example, the circular parry allows you to parry all incoming attacks regardless of direction, with no limit to the number of blows that can be parried. This seems like it only matters if there are multiple people attacking you in one action, which is not something that's in this game. So it may just be that the roll with punch rules are an artifact of the designer of the game forgetting that you can't get jumped by multiple people in one action in this game and putting in a redundant defense against a thing that can never happen. Or it might be that when he says melee round action, what he really means is melee round, and you're only meant to be able to roll with punch once per melee round, unless you have automatic roll, in which case you can do it every action of the melee round. That would be strange since you can roll with multiple things per round in other Palladium games, but then as we've already established, this doesn't work the way it does in other Palladium games for some reason. Or maybe it was meant to, but the author just didn't understand other Palladium games' combat systems. I can't imagine why. Anyway, rest assured that if you're a kung fu master and you get jumped in a dark alley by 20 guys, or if you decide to have dinner down at the old We Hate Kung Fu Bar and Grill, and the whole crowd turns on you, they either can or can't all attack you at once, and you can very effectively half the damage of their attacks, either always or one time when one guy punches you and the rest of the time you're fucked, depending on how you read the rules as described in the glossary. But you know what? Those guys are mooks. You can probably take them. It's going to be fine. And look, I think we can all agree at this point that it would be much more pleasant to simply be kicked in the head a few times than have to coherently articulate how these rules work. So you might just tell the GM, you know what? He gets me. He just kicks me right in the nose. It's fine. Let's just not talk about it. Where it really matters is when it comes to a high stakes attack. A big, big move, and you got to roll with that move. Something you got to roll a crit for, like a knockout punch or a death blow. Now, if you were to go looking about details about how to roll with punch, with a death blow, or with a knockout blow, you might be tempted to go look in the glossary under death blow or knockout punch or roll with punch. Unfortunately, there's nothing there to really guide you. However, if you were to refer to the basic overview of combat, you would find this weird little parenthetical paragraph about what happens if you roll with a knockout or death blow attack. Just by the by, this is the place in the manuscript where the author's mind turned lovingly to death blows, and so he decided to go ahead and stick the rule in here. It turns out that if you successfully roll with a knockout punch, you take double damage but are not unconscious or stunned. Now this is pretty perplexing because knockout punches don't do double damage. But apparently if you try to roll and don't get it right, you can make things a whole lot worse. So this is something you're going to want to warn people about if you are, for example, a superhero who is also a boxer, like the Golden Age Adam, Al Pratt, or like Wildcat. You're going to want to let people know, hey buddy, let it happen. Don't try to roll with this punch. I'm trying to be nice. I'm trying to be merciful and uphold the superhero code. But look, if you try to zig when you should have zagged, things are going to go wrong. Because, I mean, you could end up killing someone. Let's say you're up against a dude who's got, like, he's first level, just a absolute rookie, doesn't know anything about fighting, just somebody who made bad life choices, now he's robbing a bank. He's got, like, 13 hit points, he's got, like, 10 SDC. Meanwhile, you're this badass martial arts trained boxer, you're throwing around power punches at people, doing, like, 1d10 damage. Like all right thinking people, you've got the boxing skill, and so you've had some bonuses to your strength. You got a nice hefty +4 to damage, like Bruno in the combat example. So you go up to this hapless goon, and you pop him with a power punch. And you call it, right? Like, knockout punch. It's going to do no damage if I don't get my natural 20, but I'm hoping for that natural 20, because if I get it, then he's going to be knocked out, and I'm not going to have to, you know, do a protracted beatdown of this poor kid. So huzzah, you hit it, natural 20. And then you roll damage. You roll a 10. +4, 14, not bad. But this kid, this meaty buffoon, this sweet summer sausage, he decides he's going to roll with the punch. Terror blossoms in your eyes. And so, instead of being knocked unconscious, he takes double damage. Double 14 is 28. That's more hit points in SDC than he has. He is dead. You have killed a boy. The moral of the story is, just because you can always roll with punch, maybe, doesn't mean you always should roll with punch. On the other hand, you don't want to warn your opponent about the negative consequences of rolling with punch if you're out there using death blows. As we've discussed in the past, a death blow is a terribly suboptimal attack that requires you to call and hit a natural 20 in order to do double damage direct to hit points. That's a ton of damage, but not really useful as anything other than a Hail Mary. If you're going to do death blows, though, especially at high levels of play, you might want to go ahead and let the roll with punch play out. Because the rules on this page inform us that if you successfully roll with a death blow, instead of doing double damage direct to hit points, it reduces the target's remaining SDC and hit points by half. Not that the attack does half damage, mind you, but it cuts the opponent's remaining HP and SDC in half, just like one of those demi attacks from Final Fantasy. Now, first of all, having half your SDC wiped out is some pretty bad mojo. Like, you're lucky to hit one death blow. Your chances of hitting another death blow so you can stack on more hit point damage is not high. So taking out half of somebody's SDC might actually be a lot better, because that's probably what you're going to be chipping away at for the rest of the fight. Secondly, though, against an opponent with lots of hit points that you haven't cracked yet, reducing them by half might actually do more damage than inflicting double damage to their hit points. So it's mechanically good. Now, don't try to pin me down about the fictional reality of what's happening here, because you'll recall that a death blow is a blow where you punch somebody in the chest and stop their heart. So when somebody sees that coming, and then they try to like twist out of the way, but it doesn't quite work, and then it absolutely fucking ravages their whole body, like reducing somebody's SDC by half. Remember that SDC represents like the toughness of a boxer. So you're talking about like conditioning, muscle, bulky, brawny, other paper towel words, real tough stuff. This is a lifetime of conditioning. And a punch to the chest that stops your heart is one thing. I can understand that taking a boxer down. A punch to the chest that doesn't quite connect to the heart, but then instead just sends it like a ripple of ripped muscle through the whole body. It's like, ah, I shouldn't have rolled with that death blow. Ow. That is a little bit hard to imagine, but that is what happens. And so if you're using death blows, especially against high level people with lots of hit points, they may actually be in worse trouble if they roll with it than if they don't. In fact, there's a character like this who has all these hit points in the back of the book, a sumo wrestler with a ton of SDC and a ton of hit points. And just imagine the joy. Just imagine the exquisite delight of sending a death blow at a high level sumo wrestler NPC and having the GM in an absent-minded moment decides to roll with punch. You're like, ah, you son of a bitch. And he successfully rolls with your death blow. And instead of his heart merely stopping and then he goes on to squash you like Yokozuna, your fist connects 2 inches to the left of the heart and an atomic chain reaction of pain ripples through his fat. This 60 SDC combat monster is just reduced to a heap before you because you've found his secret fat body deflation point, apparently. Rolling with punch is one of the 5 fundamental combat actions in this game, part of the basic flowchart of combat, and fucking it up so badly that I have no idea when it can be done in combat, and it can actually make punches hurt more. It's pretty much the dumbest thing on this page. So much for the step-by-step instructions for combat. Next time we're going to be moving on to, as I mentioned before, the primary source of detailed combat rules in this game, which is the glossary, on MDC, the Mega Dumbcast. This has been Mega Dumbcast. It is Mega Dumbcast on Twitter, Instagram, Gmail, Podbean, your favorite podcatcher, etc., etc. New episodes drop every day, except for Sundays, when all the previous week's episodes drop in one big chunk for your binging convenience. MDC, Palladium Books, Ninjas and Super Spies, and all associated trademarks are property of Kevin Ciambietta. This slightly annoying theme song is Cartoon Battle by Kevin MacLeod, whose work you can find at incompetech.com. The gong sound effect was recorded by Daniel Simon. Dumbheads, I will catch you next time.